Sometimes we just look at John. That's kind of what we have to do.
That's all you have to do.
What else you gonna look at?
Look at me and there you go.
Be in awe.
You click.
Take it all in.
Click. Jeez. That's a short look. Okay. Oh, wow. All right.
Man, there's a reason I knew I didn't like coming over here.
I had the most absurd nightmare. I was poor and no one liked me.
I know what you're thinking. You seen Poggy and Beth? We can make it, baby! Me and you!
Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy are trading places.
Help! Help!
Hey, I don't want your bag, man.
Help! 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 Help!
I'll bet that man could run our company as well as your young Woodthorpe.
Are we talking about a wager, Randolph?
Is there a problem, officer?
Oh, Woodthorpe. I'm glad your parents are not alive to see this.
Wait! Now this is totally preposterous! I'm not a thief!
Here we are, William.
Take off your clothes.
You are making a career decision here.
Take off your clothes.
Did you hear what this man said to me? I have witnesses. This man is physically threatening me.
Hey, Randy, Morty, this is nice. I like this.
We are commodities brokers, William. Commodities are agricultural products, like wheat, which is used to make bread, pork bellies, which is used to make bacon, which you might find in a bacon and lettuce and tomato sandwich.
I'm considering going long on April wheat. What do you think, Valentine?
Freeze, Slimeball!
Moi?
Put that gun away at once, Winthorpe. You lost your mind?
Dan Aykroyd, Eddie Murphy. They're not just getting rich, they're getting even.
Do you have any better ideas?
Yeah, you know, it occurs to me that the best way you hurt rich people is by turning them into poor people.
Dan Aykroyd. Eddie Murphy. Ralph Bellamy.
I've got to get Wilson and tear up the sale.
Don Amici.
Randolph, this isn't Monopoly money we're playing with.
Denham Elliott.
What a scumbag.
And Jamie Lee Curtis.
By the way, food and rent, not the only things around here that cost money. You sleep on the couch.
Trading Places. It's a very funny business.
Hello and welcome to the Greaties, the great 80s movie debate, where we see if the movies from the 1980s still hold up today. We are in our holiday time. Woo.
Jingle jangle.
Whether you're a child of the 80s, a fan of classic films, or just a movie geek, you've come to the right place. Today, in our continuing holiday season movie discussion, we will be talking about 1983's Trading Places. Not spaces, trading places.
We're not talking about... Oh,
directed
man.
By John Landis and starring Bill Bellamy, Don Amici, Dan Aykroyd, and Eddie Murphy, amongst a bunch of amazing actors of the 80s. Oh, my name is Christy, and I am joined by my fellow 80s day traders.
Yeah.
John.
Looking good, Billy Ray.
Kelly.
Feeling good, Lewis.
Thank you very much.
And Steve.
Yeah.
So now on the Greaties, we like to take a moment to find out each panelist's history with the film that we're analyzing so everybody knows where everybody's coming from. So Kelly, what is your history with Trading Places? I have to really stop myself from saying
Yes. So this movie, I was pretty young when this first came out. So my first experience with this actual movie came later on when I was in high school, And my economics teacher was like, yeah, there's some stuff about the stock market in this movie. Let's just watch the whole thing.
Oh,
there are boobs in the stock market.
Yes. I think he forgot that there were boobs in the stock market.
And a lot of F.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot more than that. But, you know, he was definitely made sure that we were paying attention to
stock market.
The stock market and how it worked for like the 3 minutes that they describe it in the movie. And then we watched the rest of the movie and didn't tell our parents about it. So
good plan.
It was pretty cool.
All right, Steve.
I saw this, speaking of boobs, probably way younger than I should have. I was watching this, and maybe I was just unfazed by this back in the 80s. I was a very jaded kid, and I had seen it all. You know, I was one of those, I don't know, hard scrabble kids from the hoods in Colorado. I don't know. I saw this in probably 85.
I saw boobs every day.
Apparently, because I don't recall this, but I know I watched this when I was like maybe 10. And like, yeah, it didn't faze me, but I was watching SNL all the time. I was watching like Eddie Murphy. I'd seen Eddie Murphy Raw not long after that. So
wow.
My brother's like definitely corrupted me at a young age. So like, but I don't recall that much at all. I mean, I remember Jamie Lee Curtis. Remember that part? But the party at the house, I don't remember that. I was like, wow, I'm glad I didn't watch this with my kids. Not very appropriate.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, but my kids are older than I was when I watched it, or my oldest is. I'm like, man, what was wrong with me? Did my parents even know what I was doing? And like, no, they really didn't.
That was the beauty of the 80s.
Yeah, I know. I just had HBO, and I just watched whatever I wanted, no matter how inappropriate. Nice. And yep. Yeah, I loved this movie. I was, like I said, I loved SNL. I was a huge Eddie Murphy fan. I thought it was great. One of my favorite movies ever. Dan Aykroyd, too. Loved him.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was fantastic. I love this movie.
Cool. John?
Well, like most everybody on the panel, my introduction to Eddie Murphy was in Saturday Night Live. Actually, my introduction to Saturday Night Live was the Eddie Murphy years.
Me too.
I grew to really love the earlier years before that the most, but it was my gateway. He was my gateway into it. I just wanted to absorb anything that was Eddie Murphy because he was the it comedic actor of the time. Mm-hmm. I never got to see this or 48 Hours, which was just the either a couple months before or about a year before, because I think that was 82, 83. I can't remember exactly when in 83 this was released. My parents would not let me see anything R-rated. They would not let me take it back. They wouldn't take me to see anything R-rated.
What they didn't know.
But they were starting to relax on the R-rated movies that I could see if it happened to come in, like an HBO or mm-hmm. or if I happened to rent it, because they were very liberal about letting kids rent R-rated movies back in the day mm-hmm. until Tipper Gore messed it up for all of us.
Damn it, Tipper.
So I definitely saw this when it came out on video. Shortly after its theatrical run. And I didn't understand anything about the day trader. I was maybe about 10 and a half when I first saw it, maybe if the timeline mm-hmm. kind of holds up. But because of Eddie Murphy, I didn't care about the stock trading.
I still don't understand any of that. Makes no sense to me at all.
Yeah, I don't either. I just know that they get a lot of stress for just yelling out numbers. Honestly, this in a roundabout way, this was actually also my introduction to Dan Aykroyd. And I knew I'd seen some stuff him in some stuff, but I couldn't really quite place him because this was before Ghostbusters really blew up, my knowledge of him. So it introduced me to Dan Aykroyd. I never really saw anything that he did before this. It was just me loving Eddie Murphy and wanting to absorb anything of Eddie Murphy was introduced to this film.
I have to say, I have a similar story. I watched
pirated HBO.
Well, yes, but I think I actually watched it on TV when it came out.
Ooh, pirated TV, NBC.
Pirated NBC. No, I remember I was a huge Saturday Night Live fan. I did have a fascination with like Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood and all of those sketches that they used to have that Eddie Murphy was so expert at. And so definitely, I don't think I've ever watched this all the way through. I think I've seen it in pieces and I've stopped and watched it, but I don't think I've watched it all the way through since it came out on TV.
Okay.
Until this afternoon. When I watched it again.
She had an aversion to boobs and did not want to see boobs.
Yeah. Apparently. You see them every day, you don't care about them.
Tell me about it.
Wink, wink.
So let's start with the movie. It has a, I forgot how beautiful this opening is.
Oh, yeah.
With the classical music and all the shots of Philadelphia.
Yes.
I mean,
the juxtaposition, like the rich and the poor, the rich and the poor. Yeah, it was great.
So we are introduced to Lewis Winthrop the Third.
Winthorpe.
I looked at it and I saw it and I still ignored it. Okay, so Lewis Winthorpe.
If it's not too late, can we call a substitute? Dave, are you here?
Dave,
where are you?
How much alcohol is in that beer?
He starts his day at Duke and Duke, where everybody says hello to him.
It's Duck and Duck.
No, it is Duke and Duke. Damn it. Duquet.
Good morning, Mr. Winthorpe.
What a Dumas.
Good morning, Mr. Winthorpe. Good morning, Mr. Winthorpe. Good morning, Mr. Winthorpe.
That was a cool scene. Yeah. But we get to see how he wakes up in the lap of luxury while everything around him is not. We are introduced to the Duke brothers, Randolph, played by Ralph Bellamy, and Mortimer, played by Don Ameche.
I really...
Best.
Like the cast of Aykroyd and Murphy, they weren't familiar with Don Ameche and Ralph Bellamy, neither was I. Yeah. But ever since this movie, at least with Don Ameche, I just grew to love that man.
Oh yeah,
I'm just saying that right now. I miss him to this day because he was such a breath of fresh air. And we'll talk about him a little later, though.
So we find out that they own Duke and Duke, a successful commodities brokerage in Philadelphia. So there, Kelly, you, commodities, we've mentioned the stock market.
There you go.
Yes.
So there. They have... Go ahead.
That's it.
Yep.
That's it.
So we find out that they have opposing views on nature versus nurture.
Mm-hmm.
And they make a wager and agree to conduct an experiment, switching the lives of two people on opposite sides of the social hierarchy and observe the results.
Prince and the Pauperep.
Yes. So in the meantime, we go in to see Winthorpe goes to work at Duke and Duke, and he wins them a shit ton. He doesn't win them. He gets them a bunch of money.
With his insights to the stock market.
Insight on pork bellies.
Oh, yes. Was he pork bellies?
Which is bacon.
Pork bellies. Yeah, they both are, yeah.
It's bacon.
Nothing really bacon.
Then as they're getting out of their car, we get to intro to Billy Ray Valentine pretending to be an amputee beggar, played by Eddie Murphy.
I was in the dang Saigon.
The dang ding.
Ding dang.
Ding dang.
The dang dang.
They witness an encounter after he is suddenly made whole by the cops picking him up off his...
I've got legs.
I can see.
Hey, Jesus.
It's a miracle.
And that scam, he was using his Stevie Wonder to full tilt. It was amazing.
He was giving us a preview of Donkey.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
He was completely Donkey.
He was completely
Although I think Donkey was just Eddie Murphy.
Well, yeah.
So he doesn't really run, but he starts to get away from them and gets back in front of the doors of Duke and Duke and runs into...
It was actually the club.
Winthorpe.
Oh, the club. The club?
The exclusive club that they're dining at.
Well, he just happens to bump into Winthorpe. And, of course, club, yeah. Winthorpe being the erudite that he is, thinks he's being mugged.
Because he's got the payroll checks in his briefcase.
And Billy Ray is like, sorry, it's an accident. I bumped into you. Here you go. Here's your briefcase.
And he will not hear it. He is totally racially profiling.
Yep.
Before racially profiling was cool.
Okay. And so then I love this chase scene where he gets into the club and he's just trying to run over everything and going over everything. He's like, here, take the damn thing. Like,
why does he just drop it? Why does he go into there with the briefcase on? What are you, crazy?
Drop the
briefcase.
He's got no place he can go.
Just drop it.
He's got cops out on the outside. So that's really, he was thinking, I think he was thinking there was a back door to the place.
Yeah,
and
but
he
just still, why hold on the briefcase? Just drop it. Why
I just you, think yeah. it was a fight yeah, or flight. You're not thinking, you're just, you're
he
drilling.
He did drop it eventually.
Eventually.
Then. Yeah.
Is there a problem, officer?
Yeah, that was my favorite. Yeah. Click, click. There a problem, officer?
So as they witness this, the Duke brothers decide that they have the perfect person to switch him with, to try their experiment. So they they decide that they're going to do that. Oh, by the way, Lewis Winthrop.
Thorpe.
Damn it.
Thorpe.
Wait, I even says Thorpe. I give. Lewis Winthrop III is actually engaged to their grandniece, Penelope.
Penelope.
Yes. Great impression.
Yeah.
Lewis.
Lewis.
Oh, so sounds dreadful.
So they decide they're going to make their experiment, settling on the usual amount for the bet, and they don't ever say what that amount is. You're assuming.
Do we want to hold that bet amount until the end?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
So you assume that
it's going to be so anticlimactic, but it's funny as hell.
Assume that the stakes are high with this lovely wager, but so their plan is two specific objectives. Valentine has to become successful as an employee of the Dukes, and Louis.
Now you're making him French, Louis.
No, that's what she calls him.
Eventually.
That's still Louis
right now.
Louis must become destitute and be branded a criminal. He has to commit a criminal act. We then see these...
Not just the criminal act that they framed him for.
Correct. Yeah. Now we get to see... it's a cutaway to the exciting sex life of Penelope and Winthrop. and pretty much how put upon the butler is.
I love him.
Denham Elliott is awesome.
He was always that go-to guy.
He's got the greatest sad eyes of any actor ever. He just looks like he's about to cry the entire movie, and it's just wonderful. It's like, I mean, not that he's going to cry, just the look that he has of like dignified pain.
I want to see him and the guy from The Fifth Element.
Like his, really? Like his part. Well, his part in the charade that they're playing on Lewis, you could just tell, even when he's pretending not to know Lewis, you could just tell it's getting to him.
Yeah.
You don't think about it until later, but you're just like, why is this guy being a dick? Oh, I get it. Because he's not really, he can't really do anything because he's owned by the Dukes.
Yeah, pretty much.
The Duke Dicks.
The damn Duke boys.
He even calls them, what did he call them? Dirtbags? Douchebags?
Yeah. Douchebags. Scumbags.
Scumbags. Yes. Call them scumbags. Mm-hmm. So we get to see Billy Ray in jail telling Gus Fring from Breaking Bad and
I love it.
Better Call Saul. Giancarlo Esposito, which I found out that's how you're supposed to say his name.
Oh, not Esposito?
It's Esposito.
That was him in that?
Yes.
See, I'm really missing the fact that I haven't seen this recently because I would have caught that.
Yeah, he's the one.
He was also in Maximum Overdrive. I saw the other night. He was the guy who got shocked by the video game. Who was trying to steal the money.
He's in a lot of stuff.
I've never seen Breaking Bad. So
I didn't know he was that old.
Oh yeah, he is. He was in a Broadway play too that never got produced.
Okay.
So was I.
Never got cast either.
I love that guy. He's just that so. You're that guy.
Yeah. That guy. Him, the guy for the thing.
And then him along with Clarence Beeks, Paul...
Giamatti.
Paul Gleason. He was that. I mean, when William Atherton was not available for the asshole role, Paul Gleason stepped in.
Yeah.
And vice versa. Hmm.
So he's in jail telling Gus Fring about what a badass he is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the guy from...
The karate man shows the bruises in the inside.
So you don't know nothing.
You don't know nothing.
You know that.
And the dad from 90210 as the cop.
Okay.
I just for some reason I was like, oh, this is the dude. Paul Walsh? Yes.
My God, there's so
many. There are so many people. Like I said at the beginning, there are a lot of people.
I need to watch this movie again.
The big guy in the jail cell is probably my most quoted movie line of all time. I say that all the time.
Yeah,
exactly. But everyone always knows what I mean when I'm doing. Like,
and he,
yeah.
and he was in a hell of a lot too in the 80s. I mean, he was always that guy.
Muscle.
Yeah, the muscle. And sometimes he would always play the guy with the heart of gold, who was this big bully looking guy, but he's just a little teddy bear.
Yeah.
A little velvet teddy bear, like a little Luther Vandross.
I love those guys. Those guys are amazing.
The next day, Billy Ray is released from jail by the Dukes, who invite him into the car. And he's very suspect about anything they are doing.
He's a little suspicious, but I gotta say, after rewatching again, he wasn't.
He didn't have to be convinced that hard.
I mean, I guess you could chalk it up to
they're giving me this stuff. I might as well take it while I can.
And the driver kind of helps convince him.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
So they tell him that they're part of a group that helps culturally disadvantaged people
by giving them jobs.
By giving them a house, car, and $80,000 a year.
Which would be $190,000 in today's
I want that foundation to exist. Please.
Dig those guys up and bring them here. Okay, so they drive him to Winthorpe's house and introduce him to Coleman and pretty much say, this is your house. And he tries to pick up all the pieces.
Yeah, is my TV?
He's like pickpocketing every little thing. It's like stealing these cigars, put them in, and he's like, you're only stealing from yourself.
Yes.
These are yours. These are free. And
he gets a bath and gets to learn what a jacuzzi is.
Man, when I was young, we wanted a jacuzzi, we had to fart in a tub.
I wish you'd know. The hot tub. Ow, so hot in the hot tub.
It is a freaker. Well, it's after.
Well, maybe. It depends on how long you did that sketch.
So Winthorpe attends a meeting at the Gentleman's Club. Now, this is key.
Now, we should preface this. This is not a, air quote, gentleman's club.
No, it is actually a gentleman's hoity-toity club. Rich guy.
He ain't getting his freak on. He's
actually meeting with other gentlemen.
Yes. Oh, that didn't sound much better.
So he got a bath.
Moments before the meeting, an operative working for the Dukes, Clarence Beeks, who will come into play later, we should mention that mysterious checks are constantly going to this Clarence Beeks, and Dan Aykroyd's character first discovers it when he's having them sign the payroll checks, and so does Eddie Murphy's character later when he's passing the payroll checks. So he slips some money into Winthorpe's coat pocket.
So subtle, too.
Yeah.
So subtle.
Super subtle.
And at the meeting, they declare that there is a thief in their midst, that somebody stole money out of a coat room, and it was marked with a big red X. Yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously. And the way that they make them put their arm, the left hand, on their partner, and then reach your right hand
into the other.
And they never do the opposite pocket.
I guess they
kind of explain it by saying, like, our operatives saw it, so they would know what pocket it was in, I guess.
Yeah.
Let's
go with that because it is, I mean, it's pushing the boundaries of legal search and seizure, but.
Well, this is a private gentleman's club. Anything goes.
And also, the guys in the back row are told to do it, and they don't have a table.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyways, nitpicky stuff.
Yeah. At the meeting, he is found to be the thief, and the cash is found on his person, and then he's fired from his job. His bank accounts are frozen. He's sent to the police, and Frank Oz, again, in John Landis style, a la Blues Brothers, is a cop.
Yeah.
The opera.
No, I do remember Frank Oz being there. So
The opera.
I never realized that was Frank Oz.
Really?
Never. I mean, I don't really see him much.
I didn't realize it when I first saw it.
He's
because
so
skinny. Because I didn't really hear the Yoda pitch.
Yeah.
But then, like, after Spies Like Us and saw that he was there, and then I kept rewatching stuff. I was like, oh, yeah, that's him.
Yeah.
Yep.
He always sounds like Miss Piggy.
And Fozzie Bear.
Well, he still sounds like Yoda to me, except frontwards talking Yoda, not...
That's true. So Billy Ray goes into his local watering hole and buys champagne for everyone, where he sees the guys from his cell.
Yeah.
And then they say...
Talk about your limo.
And then go outside and look at my limo, and there's the limo outside. So now, all of a sudden, he has a lot of credibility. He throws a party at the house, and there are a lot of women in spandex.
Yeah, that is not a limo. That's like a Mercedes-Benz. They can barely fit three people in the back seat. He's like, I have plenty of room in my limo, and apparently the entire bar somehow gets into this tiny little limo, but whatever.
They don't exactly specify the time in between.
No, you don't know that
they
could have
taken
taxis.
Them in shifts.
Okay.
So it's like,
Coleman, go back and get
Coleman,
four more.
Go back and four more.
Hey, give us a number of how much you pay for your Uber, and I'll reimburse you.
Okay, so they throw a party at the house with a lot of women in spandex, and he starts getting territorial about his house, wondering about, like, you can't. This is a Persian rug from Persia.
Persia.
And then all of a sudden, we have our three topless ladies.
Yep.
Tits out. And
I've been waiting for you, Billy Ray.
Oh God! And then the dancing—the dancing unnecessarily with you. I'm gonna have to say that would be a back hazard for me. But he kicks everybody out.
Back hazard.
And then he throws Cole. He thanks Coleman for the first time in this movie.
Yeah.
That he was thanked, and you can kind of see a little.
Coleman knows. This is
a good guy.
He's not a bad guy.
Someone appreciates me.
So Penelope.
Sorry, I didn't cut you off. But it was kind of the first bonding, because even though Coleman is from a higher class of
butler
work, well, I was going to say, you know, being a butler is not obviously a high paying job.
No.
But there is a certain joie de vivre that I guess comes with it. There's a certain respect from that status.
Yeah.
Really, he's just a higher paid, you know, poor guy. I would say that is that first bonding experience that he has with Billy Ray, because Billy Ray came from the streets. He might not be as cultured as Coleman, but he knows the struggles of being walked over.
Yeah.
Looked down on. Yes. Looked down.
Actually kind of surprised when he said at the end of the party that, like, oh, we got to. I'll clean this up. I'm really surprised Billy Ray didn't kind of go, let me help you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was kind of expecting it, but I also respect the fact that he was like, you're going to start your first day at work tomorrow.
Yeah.
You might want to retire.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to retire. Okay. So when Penelope goes to pick up Winthorpe.
by the way, kudos on the proper pronunciation
Thank
of
you.
Thorpe.
Thank you very much. I have to say it quietly in my head before I say it out loud. He is accosted by eggs.
He is accosted?
It's an ice cream.
You're a crusty.
He's accosted by a prostitute, Ophelia, who is paid to do so by Beaks.
Damn Beaks.
And of course, this pisses Penelope off. And Ophelia actually asks him for a hit. So reinforcing that whole drug, because that's of anything, the big thing that Penelope's pissed about is that you're a drug dealer.
Oh, yeah, you kind of skipped over that with Frank Oz. Frank Oz planted the drugs in his coat.
But at the at the same time, I think we forgot to mention that Clarence paid Ophelia to put on a show to go up to Lewis. And make it sound and look like she was jonesing for not only said drug but said penis.
Yes.
Well, we didn't really say.
No penis. One said. That.
No, did no.
No one was gonna
it was
say
implied.
It to you.
Implied.
She was the ghost in Ghostbusters that he dreamed about.
Yes,
indeed.
So
you can also tell that Penelope is the hoity-toity 80s rich lady, because she is stuck next to people who smell,
that was
sprays perfume on. Like she Banaka. Smells them.
That's a nice purse.
That's
your purse.
To spray something good smelling, because that's what every hoity-toity 80s lady does.
I need them to smell like entitlement.
Yes, I'm going to get out my perfume that I just happen to have. Right here that I carry around with me, and I'm going to pour it all over you.
I so saw that as Banaka. I guess it could have been perfume.
Well,
yeah.
I mean,
either one is going to make them smell better.
Yeah.
It's the Willie Scott effect. Come on, this is expensive stuff.
Yep. Psst.
So she tells, she pretty much after Penelope leaves him, she kind of says, well, I was paid by your friend. And of course, when she points across the street, Beaks is gone.
You did a Batman.
Beaks was CIA.
Disappeared.
He was truly in Da Nang. He served with Billy Ray.
Da Nang.
So he then convinces her to stay with him, so that she says she'll pay for a cab for $20, and he's like, "I'll give you 50."
Yeah.
So they go to the bank.
Well, they go to his house first.
Oh, they go to the townhome, and he pretends not to know him. Coleman pretends like he doesn't know him and pretends that Coleman is not his name.
Which, Coleman. Maybe we can curtail this because I didn't get a feeling that everybody was trying to
erase Billy Race or Lewis. So I was wondering why they made Coleman.
Because he was with that other person. Yes. He wanted to. He saw the girl. He saw Ophelia. And you could tell that he was trying to prove who he was. So Coleman can't reinforce the fact that.
Right.
Yeah.
He can't. Well, he can't yes and him. But it just struck me as weird as everybody else is kind of acknowledging him. So she knows that, he might have been screwed over, but he wasn't with Penelope. He wasn't with Ophelia when he went to go see Penelope because they all acted like they knew him, but they just disowned him.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just wondering why they couldn't make Coleman part of it.
I get
the people in the bank weren't really part of it.
No, I get that. But I mean, you really have that point negated when he goes to the bank and they acknowledge that yes, you were this, but you don't have this. I'm just wondering why Coleman had to outright act like he didn't know him.
Yeah, it's kind of weird now that I think about
it. The only thing I can think is that
he didn't know how to play it, so he just kind of played it. I guess that's a fair statement, but it just struck me as always kind of a little odd.
And it kind of reinforces the fact that she still doesn't know if he's telling the truth.
Yeah.
Not until she looks at his nails.
Yeah. Well, that was before that.
Yeah.
But that's when she let him in the cab.
Yeah. So he goes to the bank and he's informed that his bank account is frozen and they have to confiscate his credit cards. So he's thrown out of the bank and out onto the street, pleading with Ophelia to help him. He reminds her that she is responsible for getting his ride to go away. Like, she helped whoever was ruining his life.
Yes.
So she agrees at that point to let him stay. And that's when when she looks at his nails and she's like, "You've never worked a day in your life, have you?"
And she has the thing I love about Jamie Lee Curtis's performance is that there are layers to her performance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
First of all, she's coming off of Scream Queen status.
Yeah.
She's a different kind of screamer in this one, but nonetheless. But she's coming off as really tough and gritty, but it's not your typical hooker with the heart of gold.
Yeah,
no.
There are definite layers to this performance that she does masterfully.
She's insightful. She's sharp. She's got a plan. She knows what she's doing. She's independent. Yeah, she's really strong.
She doesn't fully trust Lewis, but she takes a chance and lets him prove himself.
She has a plan for what she's going to do.
She does.
To make herself some money.
She has a great wig collection.
She does.
And honestly, of course, this is 10 and a half year old me watching this movie going, that's a beautiful head of hair. And when she took the wig off, it was like me discovering how they switched out the lightsabers and the Star Wars trilogy, because I was just like, what? But I should also say, and not in addition to this being in a movie that introduced me to Dan Aykroyd and Don Ameche, I didn't really know Jamie Lee Curtis that much, except for I knew that she did a few horror movies.
You got to know Jamie Lee Curtis.
I got to know Jamie Lee Curtis from this movie. I mean, I knew her of the fact that she did horror movies. I knew that, but like I said, I was a little scaredy cat of a horror movie, so I never really watched them. I think the most recent one she had done was Terror Train, I think, maybe.
Uh-huh.
But
Terror Train.
Yes, I knew I found a way to put that in there.
So we pretty much learn a lot about Ophelia, that she's really not just a hooker. She's got some brains behind her as well. And she goes to her slum apartment and she greets her neighbors, of course. And you know those guys.
You know these people.
You know these people. And he says also he agrees that he'll stay with her until he can turn his misfortune around. In the meantime, we then get to go to Billy Ray's first day of work. He is introduced to commodities, which he doesn't want breakfast. they are lined up in front of him and he pretty much equates them to bookies.
Yeah.
The Dukes.
Mm-hmm.
Winthorpe, as he's talking to Ophelia, pretty much turns all of his anger toward Valentine and pretty much says, he set me up.
Yeah, thinking that Valentine's the one that stole his life.
Yeah, and then we see topless Jamie Lee Curtis. That. I was actually surprised about that. I didn't realize that she had done that.
Right. Yeah.
But I was kind of like, but she's the mom. And
I think she took this movie
purely to be topless?
No, I don't want to say purely to be topless, but I think just all the elements that differentiated her from her scream queen status, it was completely opposite, and that had to be fun to play. I'm not saying that she was thrilled to do the nudity, but I'm thinking that she looked at it as this is a good way to differentiate me from that. And
the fact that she didn't do it in the scream, she didn't do it in the horror movie.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of other ladies
she was, the virginal queen. I mean, yeah. she was the final girl, the it girl. So.
So he discovers, like we were saying, that she's very smart, business minded, and that she has a lot of money invested in several securities, hoping to retire one day.
Yeah.
So she's got her head on straight. We go back to Billy Ray, who demonstrates he has an actual innate talent. By earning the Dukes a hefty amount on his first day at work, giving them advice on how to set the price for pork bellies.
Mm-hmm.
So he takes what Winthorpe was doing to another level. He earns up a lot of money, and on the squash court, we end up...
Squash court.
Squash.
So Winthorpe goes to the squash court, of course, in the clothes that were apparently left behind in Jamie Lee Curtis's closet.
By her old pimp, apparently. I don't know.
She says she doesn't have a pimp.
Well, I guess she got the apartment from an old pimp.
Yeah, maybe.
70s pimp.
Yes. And of course, they revile him and they don't want to have anything to do with him. Mm-hmm. And they continue to call him a drug dealer.
Selling heroin.
Yeah, selling heroin. It was PCP Angel Dust.
They also do a wonderful, wonderful Barbara yes. quartet, yes. which is, you know, how many gentlemen spend their time mm-hmm. is learning four-part harmony to sing to their girlfriends,
Constance,
you know,
about
Constance, was it
Fry?
Constance Fry.
Yeah. Then they insult their sexual promiscuity.
Yes.
Jeez.
So later on, it's raining, and Winthorpe is still wandering the city, and he sees Valentine in with some other rich friends and the Dukes, just laughing it off.
Look at that escargo!
Yeah. But the best is when everybody, it was like, what do you say, Valentine? And everybody goes, ooh. It's like an E.F. Hutton moment.
Which is so stupid because they all listen until he starts giving the answer.
Yes,
what the hell? They start talking over the answer. They're all so wanting to hear. Like, idiots.
Is he going to say something? But the best is he says, you better, looking at the jewelry on your lady here, you better just keep making money and keep her happy.
Yeah. And she was so digging on Eddie.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Wonder what she whispered to him.
We'll never know. Naughty. We'll never know. So as he's standing out in the rain, he gets sick. And second topless shot.
Yep.
I don't know why I have all the topless shots delineated, but there are several of them.
Well, she, you know, topless shot was intricate to the plot because she's trying to provide body warmth so that he warms.
Yeah, it was a very odd choice there.
He was sick and he had a fever. So why would he want to be getting warmer if you have a fever?
This is a good kind of warmth that you want to offset the bad kind of warmth. You know, because the mammary...
Titties aren't ice packs.
They're like VapoRub.
They emanate
vapors.
The mammary,
soothing.
The mammary glands provide milk and nourishment. And I'm assuming I'm not a doctor, but you know,
boobs on your back ends with a cold.
That's such a 90s rap song. Boobs on your back. Boobs on your back.
Jeez.
Oh man.
All right, as the two people that have boobs on this, I can tell you that it doesn't work.
On your back?
On my back, yes.
Okay.
Ooh.
So, after he gets better, he reads the paper and is infuriated because Valentine has made a big deal. And so he ends up at the annual Christmas party somehow in a dirty Santa outfit.
He mugged a homeless Santa, I guess.
Pretty much Billy Reese.
Well, that was probably in the pimp's apartment.
Oh, yeah.
He probably stole that.
There you go.
He is the ugliest, dirtiest Santa. He steals food.
I will.
And then he is caught planting drugs in Valentine's desk, and he holds them all at gunpoint. And that, I have to say, is one of my favorite scenes. I had forgotten about that. When he runs out and he goes, ah! Yeah. He's just got a gun aimed right up straight.
And then he leaves, and everybody's like, oh.
Yeah.
But then when he goes like this, and they all go, ooh. But
the scene that always stuck with me was when he's eating that ham on the on the L train,
and
he's got his
fish.
Salmon.
Oh, sorry, salmon. Sorry.
Yeah. Thanks, Food. Kelly.
Either way, he's got a whole beard full of hair in that salmon that he's eating, and I'm just like
the cottony hair.
I'm just like, oh, he's gotten that desperate.
Yes.
So he gets caught in the act and flees, and of course the Dukes are looking at each other going, oh,
we did it.
We have fulfilled our final point of the plan. Ha ha.
Well, not fully because I guess they were trying to also do a trick of Eddie Murphy where they left the money clip. That was early. So they're like, so that's where it kind of came full circle when they knew that Billy Ray was actually
an upstanding
citizen, decent. He's just, you know, desperate times call for desperate measures kind of person.
And
but he always does Winthorpe the right thing.
Has the gun and performs a criminal act.
Yep.
So he gets drunk and in the meantime, Valentine hides in a men's room stall to smoke one of the joints that was left behind and planted in his desk. Luckily, he happens to be in there and, you know, trying to, you know, illegally smoke a joint.
So his feet are up and
blow it out through the vent. The Dukes enter the washroom and, unaware of his presence, discuss in detail the outcome of their experiment.
A lot of detail. Like, does one of them have Alzheimer's detail? Like, you have to go over every little bit of it detail.
This is for the audience exposition.
Uh-huh. Or the people that just like had to go to the bathroom and are coming back.
Like, why is this happening? Oh, that's why. Okay. Yeah.
And Valentine's overhears all the entire exchange. And then he goes to chase after Winthorpe.
Whoa. What was the bet?
Oh, the bet. Oh,
come on, okay. You set it up earlier. You're about to skip over it?
The bet was for
$1.
$1? Oh.
Yeah. So that almost, and the worst is they try to figure out, they're like, okay, so we need to get Winthorpe back in. Nope.
They don't want him back.
He's a criminal
now. And this leads to a great line. Well, are you talking about keeping Billy Ray on? He's a Negro.
Yeah.
Oh, you watched the edited version.
Yeah.
I watched the unedited version.
No, they said that first. The other brother went straight for the full version.
No, sorry.
They said both.
I edited myself.
Okay. Oh, yes, you should.
No, they did say both.
I edited myself. I don't want that.
One brother said one way. The other one went full on.
He chases after Winthorpe and he...
Thorpe.
I said Thorpe.
You said Thrip.
Thurp. You said Thurp. You tried to rebalance it, but it was like it didn't quite fully form.
Yes, he chases after Winthorpe. Winthorpe. And then we have the wonderful salmon beard scene.
Ugh.
They decide that they're going to use his talents to corner the stock market on a specific trade commodity for a new year. So we're talking about the orange juice.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Concentrated orange juice.
Concentrated.
So he is completely drunk, and he gets at the end of the line on his bus, I guess, and he gets pissed on by a dog.
Yes,
rock bottom.
And then it gets rain. And then he gets rained on. So he decides he's going to end it all and takes the gun, puts it to his temple, and clicks it, and nothing happens.
then he throws it,
and it fires.
Wow.
That was the greatest gag I've ever had. I still laugh at that bit. It's just so guilty pleasure. Yeah.
So then he gets home, and in the whole time, Valentine is following him in the taxi, follows him to Ophelia's house, and he just kind of walks in, closes the door, and is in the bathtub and takes a bunch of pills that he was planning to plant on Valentine.
Mm.
And luckily, Valentine walks in and they bust in on him and get him
before he falls through
it. Yeah,
get him before it takes effect.
Yes. And then when he wakes up, he's in his old bed and Coleman is there and a doctor has said he'll, you know, just keep him calm. And he it was all a dream, Coleman. It was all a garish nightmare. I thought I was And there's Eddie Murphy right
and,
there.
And then he goes to choke. It was not Dukes. It was not Dukes.
It was not Dukes.
Gets up and tries to kill him. They also on television. Now, this was very odd to me that they're talking on television. They learn that Clarence Beeks is transporting a secret report on orange crop forecasts from Washington, D.C. to Washington.
No,
I thought it was from Washington to New York.
From Philly to New York. Well, yeah. No, they go somewhere else. I can't remember now either.
It was going to Washington D.C.
Yeah, from Philly.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh, because they had to.
They had to get it to the Department of Agriculture.
Agriculture.
Gotcha.
That's right.
That's right.
So the report is going from Philadelphia to D.C.
Okay.
And Clarence Beeks, because he's in charge of this whole security firm, he's the one that's in charge.
And he's giving them insider trading information. Not knowing. Based on
they both hear, Clarence Beeks, he's the one I saw the paycheck for.
Ophelia recognizes him. That's,
yes.
That's
the link.
That's how they're able to pinpoint him, is because Ophelia's like, hey, that's the guy that paid me to do that to you.
And they also recognize his name from the checks that they were told not to question.
Mm-hmm. Would you think he would go by an alias on the?
You'd think. Yeah.
But
and why pay him in checks?
Right.
Yeah.
Pay him in cash later. Yeah. Whatever.
So they decide between all three of them and Coleman. Coleman's in on it too. That they decide that they figured out that they are going to corner the market on frozen orange juice. And they're going to disrupt their plan as revenge.
Mm-hmm.
So
and turn the tables on them and make them poor because, from my experience, rich people do not like to be poor.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So okay. Valentine overhears, on purpose, Beeks's call and learns of his New Year's Eve travel plans. On the train, on the Amtrak.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That is currently, conveniently, having a New Year's party. With a masquerade.
Well, it is New Year's Eve. So.
With Jim Belushi in a grill outfit.
James Belushi.
Al Franken.
Yeah, Al Franken.
And Davis.
Jim slash James Belushi. He always went with Jim James.
Yeah. Jimmy James. Depends on how big his character was.
Yeah.
It was more like his brother. It was Jim, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So, Valentine, we get to see Al Franken and Tom Davis. In the first,
as
the guys who are like the stone baggage handlers,
and the
guy from Airplane who introduces the gorilla, very toned down. But we get to hear that they have to transport him and they have tranquilizers.
Mm-hmm.
Yep,
ooh. Foreshadow. So the four get aboard the train and they the costume parade that comes up because they're all dressed up. But we start with. Eddie Murphy as an exchange student from Cameroon.
Another one of my most quoted lines ever. Every single New Year's Eve, I say this line. Merry New Year!
Thank you for correcting my English, which sucks.
Merry Happy New Year!
and that, and
and then we get to see Denham Elliott comes in as an Irish priest.
Top of the morning.
And Ophelia is Inga from Sweden.
Yeah, for sure, from Sweden.
But Coleman has to correct her and say, why aren't you wearing lederhosen and you're supposed to be from Sweden?
Yeah, I'm sure from Sweden.
And then, of course.
Oh, boy.
Winthorpe has the very culturally insensitive Jamaican.
At least this scene could not be made today.
No.
Anywhere.
He seems to have survived it, though.
Yeah.
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 He's fine. Unlike C. Thomas Howell.
But yeah. Honestly, I think that people look at this as seeing, well, Clarence Peake knows what Lewis Winthorpe looks like.
Yeah.
Yes.
It is a disguise. It's not it's one time where they look at intent.
Yeah.
The intent is not to offend. The intent is to mask.
Yeah.
So.
Yes. Murphy's cool with it.
Was a blackface character the best way to go?
Probably not. No.
But
he could have been like any sort of masked person or animal or could have been like a female gorilla. I don't know.
It could have been anything, but they chose.
No,
this.
Clarence was the female gorilla.
Yes. He wanted to be a Jamaican, I guess.
So. Eventually. Yeah.
This was back in the day where not to excuse anything, but Hollywood was more laid back about things. They didn't look at everything. They didn't look at everything from a culturally sensitive.
They didn't look at it from who would we offend if we did this.
Comedy was just comedy.
Yeah.
It's not meant to be offensive. No one's going to be offended by this. It's funny. That's the way they're looking at it. Like, no, it's not going to offend him. You know, it's just a character. You know, he's just doing something. This rich guy thinks he can be this rich guy thinks he can have the disguise as Jamaican. That's absurd. That's how it was seen. It wasn't we're going to offend or make fun of Jamaicans. It's like, no, this is something some privileged white guy would do to try and make a costume.
Yep.
And tomorrow it would lose him the Senate.
Yep.
Yes.
Thank God he did.
You would hope.
Yeah, you would hope.
We don't know.
Well, tomorrow maybe not so much.
So they use it as an opportunity to swipe the briefcase and switch them.
Yes.
But Beaks wises up and uncovers their scheme. In chasing them, he attempts to actually kill them, takes them all the way to the end car where the gorilla is.
And he barely doesn't notice the gorilla at all. He's just standing there. He walks up to the gorilla, turns around, back to the gorilla, never even acknowledges that there's a gorilla like an inch behind him. It's very odd.
So it's the gorilla in the room.
Yeah.
So. I mean, this is probably an obvious point, but were they trying to get that Beaks was like a former CIA operative of some sort that didn't have a problem with eliminating the
I think so. Probably. I think
was that a little bit from his background?
I think we're talking what was that one? Blackwater? No, what was that one? Halliburton. Halliburton. Yeah. I would equate it to like a Halliburton.
Yeah. That's fair.
Mercenaries for
paid hire. Mercenary, yeah. Possibly. Yeah, CIA background.
So he fails in doing that. He is subdued by Jim Belushi coming in the...
Come on, the party's over. It's not even 10:30.
And he ends up knocking him out and knocking Jim Belushi out as well.
Well, as the gorilla. And the gorilla got pissed and said, you hit my man. And then...
Oh, you hit my woman.
My woman. Bam.
Yeah. So they decide to tape his mouth. And put him in the gorilla costume.
Somehow tape the head on, too, I guess, because he can't get the head off.
He can't get the head off. And lock him in the cage with the real gorilla. So the forgery is then successfully delivered to the Dukes by Valentine, who pretends to be Beaks.
Mm-hmm.
Eddie Murphy's worst impressions.
Yeah.
Over here.
I'm really surprised.
Like a Jewish lady.
They could have just taken him. They could have taken Paul Gleason's voice and just kind of... Well, they could have faked it.
Well, I also equated it that he just got lucky because they probably had very minimal contact with Beaks. Yeah. They couldn't recognize his voice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm overthinking this.
Yes, you are. It's okay. Yeah. So Winthorpe and Valentine travel to New York, but before they do, they are given the life savings of Coleman and
Ophelia
to use as part of their trading.
Stocks, yeah.
And they go to the commodities trading floor to execute their plan. And I love how when it's almost time for the floor to open, that they all leave the men's bathroom. Yeah. They all leave the bathroom stalls like it's a freaking horse race.
Yeah.
Ding, ding.
Ding, ding. Winthorpe and Valentine are able to...
My economics teacher would have loved to have pointed out at this point in time that this is a very common practice to this day, that stock traders are so stressed that they usually are having ulcers and their hair is falling out. And they are some of the most stressed out group of people that you will ever meet, because it's just day in, day out, you're fighting.
Wow.
And yelling and running. And
I'll be honest with you, I stress out just watching them.
Yeah. I have no idea what's going on in that scene at all.
I would not want. I mean, it's just a bar brawl that
happens. Keep track of any of that. They're just,
yeah.
I don't get it. They're just like jotting things on paper and throwing things around at each other.
You kind of look at when they actually get on the floor and you look at the paper, it's just scratches. I mean, I'm like, what does that mean?
What does it mean?
And a lot of them are using hand signals. It's like, oh, are you waving the runner in? Or are you, what are you doing here? And
it's crazy. I don't understand it. I don't know what they were doing, how that works, how it's official, how any of it works at all makes no sense to me.
The fact that you just said that proves why our economy is in such a high,
that
because we have no idea why.
We have no idea. We have no idea where the money's going.
It's held together by coal. It's held together by clouds and that gorilla from the Gorilla Glue commercial.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So they are able to turn an enormous profit while the Dukes, misled by the false report, commit all of their belongings. Mm-hmm. So about
their whole
$394
life
million dollars,
yeah, which would be at least double that in today's money.
Oh yeah.
They're ruined.
They make their way down, they confront Valentine and Winthorpe on the exchange floor, who mockingly explain that they made a $1 wager.
Thank you, Lewis.
Thank you. Yeah. And whether they could get rich while also making the Dukes poor.
and they did.
Yeah, and then Valentine collects his prize from Winthorpe, and Randolph actually has a heart attack right there. Mortimer protests.
Open the stocks back up. Open the trading. I demand it. You know what? If you watch it in today, I can swear I hear somebody say, stop the voting.
Yeah.
Stop the voting. I demand you open the recount.
Recount.
Turn
the machines back on. Keep counting.
Since they cannot pay it in cash, their seats on the exchange are put up for sale, and their assets are seized and their holdings frozen. Meanwhile, they kind of say, Mortimer's being taken away, he keeps saying, where's Meex?
Oh, yeah.
And then, Meex, where's Meex?
I would like to also point out how the champ of this scene with Amici when Bellamy's character is being taken out, and they're like, what about your brother? Fuck him. but not only was that a brilliantly delivered panic attack with vulgarities thrown around, the fact that Don Amici was such a strong conservative religious believer felt so awkward delivering that F-bomb. He was like, you're only going to get one take at this.
Oh, yeah?
And
yep. It
was done in one take, and that's all you get.
Wow.
He would not do another take because he was so uncomfortable with he was even uncomfortable with the racial undertones of it. Calling him a Negro.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Edited. That's why I love him. He's like one of the last true good guys in of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Doing something he doesn't want to do, but he knows it's good for the scene.
Yeah.
But you're only going to get one, saying this in
you
one
get
take.
It once, and that's it.
And that's it.
Yeah.
So meanwhile, we see Beaks and the gorilla are loaded onto a ship headed for Africa because it was an experiment.
Oh, they look happy.
And while Valentine,
one gorilla in there.
Yeah, one gorilla, two gorillas. What's the matter? Who cares? He looks happy.
We doubled the investment.
I think the black one's the woman. Or the female, whatever.
While Valentine, Winthorpe, Ophelia, and Coleman are on a luxurious tropical vacation.
Yeah.
With an unnamed partner for Eddie.
Yeah, exactly.
And for Coleman as well. They all end up with, and he gets to order a servant around.
He got his own little servant, yeah.
The servant to the servant.
And that is the end of the
movie. Prima good, Mr. Coleman, sir.
So that is the end of the movie.
Is it?
That is.
But what happened to the brothers?
They're feeling good.
What happened to them?
Watch Coming to America.
Aha!
I don't think we've done that one because
we have.
Have we?
Yes, I have done.
Yes, I love that's that they came first. Back in a future.
Oh, it was
movie.
Perfect.
That was one of the best callbacks ever.
And, yeah. and it was funny because I'm sitting here laughing my ass off when I see that movie in the big screen for the first time. And people I'm with have no clue what's going on. But like, there's like half the audience that knows and then half the audience that
Mortimer,
doesn't.
We're back.
We're back. So let's get to some trivia, shall we?
Okay.
This film was actually conceived for as a vehicle for Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor.
Okay.
But when Pryor dropped out, Eddie Murphy came on board. Murphy tried to get Wilder replaced because he didn't want people to think he was just trying to be Richard Pryor.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And thinking about it in hindsight, what an honor it is to because you know it's well documented what a big fan of Richard Pryor that he is to take a role that was intended for him, and I mean doing his own thing, but at the same time going this if this is worthy of Richard, imagine what I can do with it too.
Yeah. Eddie Murphy later admitted that he in the final final scene in the exchange he stuck specifically to the script because he had no idea what was going on.
As did the audience.
Yeah. The scene where Mortimer Duke is trying to catch the money clip and having trouble.
Yeah.
That actually was a glitch.
That was awesome.
But he kept going with it, not breaking character, so it was kept in.
Yeah.
The Swedish disguise came about because Jamie Lee Curtis couldn't do a correct Austrian accent.
It really worked with the scene because it wasn't intended to be, it's a costume party.
Mm-hmm.
How many people go with authentic?
Right.
Not that many.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
In Philadelphia, in the Westin Hotel, there is a restaurant called Winthorpe and Valentine after the two main characters in the movie.
Nice.
Let's see.
I want to go to there.
Me yeah, too. Now I do.
I totally want to go there.
We can all make a trip. Let's make a Grady's trip.
I work for the company. I can get a discount.
We'll round up Dave.
Yes, we'll get Dave. Dave will show us where to go.
Heck yeah.
According to John Landis, actually had to campaign for Jamie Lee Curtis to be in this.
Wow.
Because they said that she'd only done horror films and wasn't known for comedy.
Mm-hmm. She really proved herself in
this. Oh, she did.
She rocked.
A thousand times over.
I think this is stupid funny that in releasing his financial records for 2012, Al Franken revealed that he still gets royalties for this film.
Of course he does.
That's great.
Why and it's nothing illegal either. It's just, that's an honest, for a congressman, or senator, that's an actual, honest claim.
That's awesome.
There's a couple of things that are John Landisisms, as I like to call it. The prison number for Dan Aykroyd is the same as Jake Blues.
Ah, nice.
Oh.
Yep. Randolph Duke and Mortimer Duke always wear matching suits and tie patterns, but Randolph wears a bow tie. Mortimer wears a necktie.
Okay.
I thought that was cool.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed at one scene they're putting on, like, I think it was a scarf or something, and one was red, one was blue.
Yeah.
I thought it was kind of interesting.
We kind of glanced on it, is that Ralph Bellamy and Don Ameche, like, we don't know who Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy are, and Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd said, we don't know who Belle Bellamy and Don Ameche are.
But they so got along famously with each other. It was amazing. You could tell it in the play.
One thing that kind of stood out is World Trade Center.
Yeah.
In that one scene.
Yeah. Wow. Just hits.
And their commodity exchange was used for the trading scenes.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Well, I'm glad that Hollywood hasn't gone back and retroactively removed the World Trade Center from every movie. I mean, it's really awe-inspiring to see it way back in its glory. But at the same time, when they're going crazy about any movie that had a shot of the World Trade Center and removing the Trade Center, I equated that to grandmother died, let's remove every picture in the house from her.
Yeah.
You'd want to remember that, especially if it's used in a scene that's kind of glorious.
I guess I never really thought that, you know, before I saw the movie again, like, that's where the trading happened, was there. Like, duh, World Trade Center. Like, oh, what? So what did they do in the time before the new one built? They just have, like, somewhere else they went? I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, they also have the New York Stock Exchange. Yes. That's like the main trading floor.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. I didn't know
We can go there too on a Grady's expedition if you like.
Yeah, okay.
You can go to the New York Stock
Exchange. I can learn my stuff.
Another Landisism. John Landis loves to use Frank Oz as a police officer. We kind of went over that.
Yep.
He was the officer who gave Jake Blues his property back. And he was also reclaimed his role in Blues Brothers 2000.
Oh. Never saw Blues Brothers 2000.
Me neither. I never saw the first one. I know. I've never seen Blues Brothers.
So. I've only seen it once many years ago. I could not quote it at all. Yeah. So you're in good company.
Okay, good.
What?
Sorry, I've seen parts of it. It just never struck me as something I want to watch. I don't know why.
As a lady from Chicago, I am very, very offended.
I'm sorry.
Oh man.
I know. As someone who's an SNL fan, I don't know how I've just never seen it.
Fan.
I know. I don't know what's wrong with me. I should watch it, but every time I try, I'm like, nah, I just don't want to.
Listen to our episode because there are a couple Blues Brothers on it.
Kelly, yeah. I'm giving him a knuckle noogie as we speak. So don't worry. That's for you. That's
not where you're supposed to do that.
Thank you.
Wait a minute. In order to get their research together, they actually met with drunk traders.
Ah, wow.
They hung out in Los Angeles because it was 3 hours behind, and they had their happy hours very early in the day.
Okay.
So they were drunk by 2 p.m.
Ah, I see.
That's great.
Day traders.
I thought this was just cool for theater kids. The punchline, and movie geeks, the punchline of Bunny's story, "And she stepped on the ball," is actually from MAME.
Okay.
When she tells a joke with the same punchline.
I see. I'm not a theater kid.
Stepped on the ball.
Ooh.
So this came out shortly after the Twilight Zone movie and the court case and everything. And there was a very strong relationship between John Landis and Eddie Murphy, which kind of fell apart after the court case.
Yep.
He was expecting Eddie to stand up for him, and I guess Eddie didn't really take a side or anything. Something along those lines.
He subtly indicted him in the accident, or just assigned him some of the blame.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the quote in the interview, "I don't want to say who was guilty or who was innocent, but if you're directing a movie and two kids get their heads chopped off at 12 o'clock at night when they ain't supposed to be kids working, you said action."
Yeah.
You have some sort of responsibility.
But he's not wrong.
He's not at all. But that did definitely change their relationship.
Mm-hmm. And there was definitely a heavy tension there that you could feel that in Coming to America.
Yeah. Hmm. So this film was inspired by a tennis game. Timothy Harris, the writer, the screenwriter, there were these two brothers who were both doctors that he would play tennis with on a regular basis. And they were incredibly irritating to play because they had a sibling rivalry all the time about everything. And so he presented the idea of brothers arguing nature versus nurture to his writing partner, and that's what started it.
Oh, okay.
So it started from having to observe these two brothers trying to play tennis.
I see.
There is a scene in the movie that isn't in the theatrical cut, but it's in the television cut.
Mm-hmm.
That occurs after Beaks talks to the Dukes on the phone, and Billy Ray overhears them. In the original, Beaks goes from the telephone booth to the Amtrak plane platform holding the briefcase with a prop report. In the added scene, we see Beaks procure the reports from a secured vault where he drugs a security guard and opens a safe deposit box.
Ooh.
That's weird.
Yeah, I know.
Scandalous.
I know. It's a little weird. And I don't know that it contributes anything.
Yeah, I don't understand. That's weird.
Maybe it just was there to put the linchpin that he's
bad.
Shady is bad. And
yeah.
Well, and also can get things done on his own. He's not paying anybody else. Like he's actually going in and doing the dirty work himself.
Okay. I guess I just assumed that he was officially the one who was getting the crop report.
Yeah.
It was all legit.
Apparently not.
He was on the news saying he's the one doing it.
I know.
That doesn't make any sense. Oh, whatever.
The baggage handlers were supposed to be Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas.
Oh, that would have been awesome.
I know.
Is that why Franken and Davis kind of
because
Canadian?
That fell through, and then Dan and Eddie like said, hey, what about these guys?
Yeah.
So that's where they're a little Canadian in their thing.
Yeah, okay. A little bit.
A little bit, Doug. A
little bit.
Doug McKenzie. All right.
When it was shown on television, April 1987, which is probably when I saw it first.
Took that long to edit all the curse and nerdity out of it.
It was the highest rated theatrical film broadcast on any network.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Nice.
Because Eddie still had this big star that, and anybody would watch anything with Eddie, especially because not everybody had HBO, not everybody had the premiums because they were just gouging. And that was sometimes the only time that you could see Eddie Murphy on the small screen because he had since left Saturday Night Live.
Yep.
Yeah.
The original title was Black and White.
Mm.
Yeah.
Better name. Yeah.
The beauty of this movie is yes, there's racial overtones in this movie, but they're subtle, and to specifically call the movie as a racial overtone would have undermined.
It was more about trading spaces. It's more about trading
spaces. When Eddie Murphy decides to re-renovate.
He kind of did renovate the house a little bit by having all his hoe friends out.
Yep. Yeah.
But
you might not want to lay on that bed.
As somebody who has taken a couple of workshops on anti-racism and all the things that we are currently in discussion with in our society now, I think that you learn that there's more than just race that is involved in oppressing people, mm-hmm. and that class plays a part in it. Being a woman plays a part in it.
Mm-hmm.
That your occupation plays a part in it. There's so many different layers of being oppressed.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that's really what this movie is about. Is about like you can see kind of what's on the other side of the fence here, but in reality, it's still Eddie Murphy's character is still a puppet.
Yep.
Yeah.
And
even though he crosses over the boundaries of what he would think would be, a dream. Like you get a house and a job and you have all this money that you weren't having before, you're still being a puppet in this game.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was gonna say this movie, it would, I don't know, it depends a lot on Eddie Murphy, but it's not, it doesn't necessarily have to be. And it could have been like some white, poor white dude. It really could have worked depending on the actor and the commitment.
It was
so
interchangeable.
It wasn't really based on race. It was based on class and like status.
Yeah.
In the same vein, it was really honest because really that's all you really saw back in the 80s was black and white.
Mm-hmm.
So you definitely had to have a white guy in the Dan Aykroyd part. That was a given. I do agree that it could have been anybody. It could have been a poor... Hell, it could have been Dan Aykroyd playing a dual role.
Yeah.
Honestly, to show the duality
of...
duality of Prince and Pauper. It just lent itself to be a more honest than you would think a movie like that would be.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I agree with that.
Now, when they are in the fancy restaurant and he's standing outside in the rain and he's watching through the movie... The music, there's a lot of stuff reused from other John Landis films. The music that is playing in the background is the same that was used in the Blues Brothers when Jake and Elwood are dining in the fancy restaurant.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Which you wouldn't know because you haven't seen Steve.
I wouldn't.
Okay.
God, Steve, get your life together.
Jeez.
This began like a couple of movies that Dan Aykroyd and Jamie Lee Curtis were in that they were friends who become romantic. We'll talk My Girl 2. Christmas with the Cranks.
Huh. Yep.
Yeah.
Billy Ray Valentine is based on a Twilight Zone character named Henry Valentine in season 1, episode 28, The Nice Place to Visit. A small town crook, Henry, is killed and given everything he desires, but then he gets weary of always winning.
If you're complete with your trivia, I have one that I think you'll find especially
exotic, shall we say.
Okay, okay.
In keeping with our Christopher Guest momentum, his brother, Nicholas Guest, and Jamie Lee's future brother-in-law has an appearance as Harry.
I think he's in the police station. I think I saw that when I saw the credits. I was like, oh, there's...
Probably, but he is in this.
There's a guest in this.
And I can I just confirmed it with IMDb that it was him.
Oh, I don't know. Okay.
Very nice. All right. Now let's get to our ratings.
Okay.
So, remember, we're going to rate it on a scale of 1 to 5.
2 to 7. Bye.
1 to 5.
2 to 8.
1 to 5.
5 to 1.
At, sure. And we're going to rate it when we saw it originally and versus how we think of it now. So, anybody but John, let's talk to...
Thank you for asking, Hoda.
I'm going to let you answer, but first, you know.
Let's go to Steve.
Ah, I loved this movie when I first saw it. Like I said, I blocked out a few things, strangely, but...
Boobies. No,
boobies. I don't know why I blocked them out. I loved it. It's always been one of my favorite movies. Like I said, I quote it all the time. It's just a classic. I would have given it a 5 back in the day. Mm-hmm. I watched it yesterday, and I don't think it's changed at all. I love this movie. It's still a 5. It holds up 100%. I mean, there's a couple of culturally insensitive things probably wouldn't fly today, but like we discussed, it was, you know, that's sensibilities of the 80s. I don't think it was meant to offend at all. Still give it a 5.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Kelly.
So, again, going back to when I first originally saw it, which was in school, and it was in
awkward.
What was going through my head was, why have I not heard of this before? I was the girl at 4 years old watching old SNL with Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd and the original cast. And, you know, so I was just astonished that I made it all the way to my senior year of high school and hadn't ever watched that movie before. So I think at that point I would have given it a 4 because I didn't really have the true experience of experiencing it in a theater or at my house and definitely not around my teachers. But now I give it a 5 because I think, again, I think comedy is the best way that we are able to look at ourselves. And in those terms, I feel like it speaks to us now as a culture just as much, if not more, as it spoke to the culture back at that point. Yep. That of really recognizing that we really are all in this together, and we need to come together if we're going to all succeed as a society. That's what I really get out of the movie. And you know, it just so happens to be hysterically funny, you know, so that's a great cherry on top of this really lovely Sunday of a movie. So I give it a 5.
Yeah. I had to get that in.
Sorry, John's breaking my equipment. John,
children are being very disrespectful while you're trying to
your
talk.
Your equipment is limp.
My equipment is being fucked with. That's what it is. Okay, so
this podcast is now officially rated PG-13. Actually, rated R because we just slipped in 2 F bombs. Nice.
Yeah, I think you're up to like 4.
Yeah.
Okay. Well.
All right.
Fuck that.
Hey, John. John, why don't you fucking tell us what your fucking rating is?
Jesus.
Hey, fuck you, fuckbag. I'll tell you what my rating is. Oh, yeah, I'll tell you.
Such language.
This was like opening up the candy store when the parents weren't home. I was able to watch it on HBO. I think it was HBO. We had it on a free weekend. I might have rented it. It was Eddie Murphy. Eddie Murphy could do no wrong for me in the 80s. He was a masterful comedian. Mm-hmm. He could do no wrong. This movie, I would say, was a 5 easily, hands down, like everybody else is saying. Rewatching it, I'm on the gravy train. I don't think there's anything that has changed. I go in. I still find myself quoting the movie. The one different aspect that I'm gonna say about it, and is actually really good, is that this was really a mature Eddie Murphy that I saw, and a performance wise.
he was two different characters. Mm-hmm. I mean, granted, I know he goes on to play multiple characters in movies. That's what he's known for. But this is when he showed two different characters without having to do makeup, having to do because he was this typical Eddie Murphy trying to play a scam artist. But then I think his true his true maturity shows in his character once he's given the means that he can support himself. Dan Aykroyd was amazing. I'm glad that I got introduced to him in this movie. Jamie Curtis, hubba hubba, nice breast. But great, solid performance. Way to own a role that could have very well been, you know, easy.
Demeaning.
Yeah. Could have been, it was stereotypical.
Yeah.
And just doing something fresh with it.
Mm-hmm.
This is really a great introduction to all of these actors because it shows the talent that they had that for whatever reason, people are forgetting that they have this talent. Dan mm-hmm. Aykroyd, because he's done a lot of crap in between Trading Places and now. Eddie Murphy has done a lot of crap.
Norbit.
Jamie Lee Curtis
has the 2000s.
Jamie Curtis has done some crap, but her talent has never waned for me.
No.
She is a goddess as far as I'm concerned. I'll go with the flow. I think it's still a 5. Yeah. There are a few things that are dated, but you're just along for the ride. I just love everything about this movie.
Yep.
I would say that I don't think it's fair to rate it from my original viewing because I don't think I saw it all the way through. Mm. So I wouldn't put it like as 3 in pieces, but I definitely, in watching it, you know, sometimes when you're watching a movie and you've watched it before and you feel like you know it,
mm-hmm.
you kind of get distracted. You sit on your phone and you pet the dog and you do other things and you don't pay attention. I paid attention to this movie the whole way through.
Yeah.
Like, because I didn't want to miss anything. And while there are some dated aspects of it, I feel like the comedy is so essential. Like, there aren't throwaways. Mm-hmm. There, everything has a purpose. And I love the fact that it is not, even though I'm going to say that it took me aback when I first saw Jamie Lee Curtis take her shirt off. Because I was like, what is she doing? She's Jamie Lee Curtis. Why is she taking off? But she wasn't
Activia.
Jamie Lee Curtis at that point. She was just, you know, fledgling actor. This is her first non-horror movie. And that's what they did to mm-hmm. try to, unfortunately, justify being a serious actress, even in a comedy, but you had to show some today.
Yeah, and there was it wasn't as prevalent as it is now. I mean, there are actresses now that specifically have a no nudity clause. Actresses back in that day really couldn't do that. That was a kiss of death for a career.
Well,
usually.
Also in the fact that you think about the fact that she is portraying a prostitute. It who is going itself. To be comfortable with showing her body. And that is one of her tools as a working girl.
Mm-hmm.
So you think about it that way. You're like, okay, that it can be justified roundabout by part of the characters. That is not out of the, or it's not gratuitous. It is, you know, she feels comfortable taking her clothes off because she
They didn't linger on her.
No, they didn't. And in fact, she at one point covers up.
It's
like said, she's
that's not the only. It's thing very that costs money around here.
It's very. It's acknowledged.
Yeah,
and that I think kind of makes it. It made me not feel as that she was as objectified. And then the times that it happened, it really wasn't. It was justified.
Mm-hmm.
She's taking off her clothes. Take off your clothes. You don't necessarily worry about having to put a shirt on, you know, that kind of thing. So I was worried that when that first happened, it really kind of jarred me and I thought it was going to change the way that I viewed it. But I'm going to say I flat out laughed several times during this. And like, I was riveted in watching to see what would happen next, because like I said, I watched it in very disjointed fashion. I am going to have to agree and give it a 5.
Yeah.
So
yay!
I don't think we even need to do the math. It really is a really good movie. And if for some of you that might be wondering who haven't seen this movie in a while, why we chose this as a holiday movie, it is because it takes place at Christmas. Not that it wouldn't work any other time of the year, but it's pointedly, it definitely works at Christmas
mm-hmm.
and winter in mm-hmm. Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Like, it has to be cold. It has to be, like, if it wasn't set in winter, I wouldn't feel that it would have that mm-hmm. same feeling. Yeah. So let us know. We are actually talking about several holiday-ish.
Nuggets.
We are talking about several holiday movies around this time. So let us know what you think of Trading Places. Let us know on our Facebook page or our Twitter. And if you like what we do and you want to support what we're doing, please feel free to contribute to our Patreon. It is patreon.com/neozaz. We have a bunch of different shows to check out. Thank you so much for joining me. Kelly, thank you from the remotes of the ether.
Yes. I'm in the remote.
Thanks, Kelly.
And welcome.
And as always, thank you so much, Steve.
Yeah.
John, you showed up.
Thank you. Did you even invite him, or he just kind of just shows up?
So thank you so much for joining us. And join us next week as we talk about another holiday 80s nugget of joy. Woo. Cool.
Bye.
Hello. Oh, my screen just went out. Okay.
Wait.
Hello and welcome to the Greaties, the great 80s movie. Oh, wait, no.
Oh!
Son of a...
Really?
I forgot I was going to start it special. Okay. Whether you are a child of the 80s, a flan...
Flan, I'm a flan.
You're a flan. Whether you're
Take
a child...
Two.
So, my name is Christy, and I am joined by my fellows down on their outers.
What?
No. This
down
is...
on their outers?
My fellow 80s...
Would you
down
like a
in...
second
Yes,
second
I would
shot.
Like it. I am...
I am joined by my 80s illustrious guest host.
No, that's not it.
I'm sorry. I just don't remember your... I'm sorry.
Steve Grogan
I'm
has
drunk.
Alzheimer's combination
I
of that and a cocktail.
I have given him one cocktail.
I am a lightweight. I just don't remember your description of it. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Wow.
When you listen to it,
Kelly, I remember every word you said. I was on.
Riveted.
I was on the edge of my seat when you were telling your story. Yeah. I just want you to know that, my new friend.
I apologize. I saw a Rocky statue when I went to Philly, and I had a Philly.
You had a Philly.
Yeah. Not while looking at the statue. That'd be crazy. But I got a Philly.
Like the horse?
Like the, no, the sandwich.
I had a little Philly.
Okay. I had a little Philly. All right. Jeez.